Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's start the programme in Azerbaijan, which is hosting the annual UN Climate Conference, COP29, in Baku this week. Heads of state have been meeting there today. When Petrostate Azerbaijan was declared the host of this summit, there were some raised eyebrows and even some anger among environmentalists that the country has made public its plan to expand gas production by up to a third over the next decade, just as the function of the COP summit is to drive down reliance on fossil fuels and to slash CO2 emissions. Well, the first leader to speak today was President Aliyev of Azerbaijan, and he said countries shouldn't be blamed for wanting to use natural resources like oil and gas. Not exactly the message many environmentalists wanted to hear.
It's a gift of the God. Every natural resource, whether it's oil, gas, wind, sun, gold, silver, copper, all that are natural resources. And countries should not be blamed for having them and should not be blamed for bringing these resources to the market, because the market needs them. The people need them.
Well, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had strong words on the human cost of the climate crisis and the urgency of action.
This is almost certain to be the hottest year on records. And the masterclass in climate destruction. Families running for their lives before the next hurricane strikes. Biodiversity destroyed in sweltering seas. Workers and pilgrims collapsing in insufferable heat. Floods tearing through communities and tearing down infrastructure.
The BBC's environment correspondent Matt McGrath is at the climate summit in Baku. So there seems to be mixed messages today coming from the leaders in Baku. Does that signal problems ahead for the summit?
I'm not sure it signals problems, Rebecca, but I think it does show that there's a great deal of difference between leaders about what the real focus of this conference should be. You heard from President Aliyev there, the Azerbaijani host, showing, a great deal of anger, at what he might consider the hypocrisy of some countries, like the European Union, which has been happy to do oil gas deals with Azerbaijan, but at the same time, in his view, criticizing Azerbaijan for producing more gas. Amongst the leaders, there was a lot of different viewpoints made today. Many of them talked about climate impacts, how the impacts are really hitting home and destroying their homelands. Many of them talked about wars, and many of them talked about money. Very few of them actually talked about fossil fuels, the main cause of the warming we're experiencing. Hilda Heine, the president of the Marshall Islands, did talk about that, and she talked about the fact that, you know, will those that defy the agreement that we have to transition away from fossil fuels and go home and pump more oil and gas, will they be held to account? So I think, you know, there's a wide range of viewpoints here and a lot of uncertainty, basically, as to how this COP might be able to help them to deal with the issues of climate.
Matt, one of the big things they are discussing today is this thing called the Climate Market Agreement, which sort of involves carbon trading. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, this is the last outstanding piece of the Paris Agreement that's been put in place in 2015. And essentially, it governs the way that countries can, richer countries at least, can offset some of their carbon by buying projects in poorer countries or paying for forests to be kept standing in poorer countries. Those types of bargains, if you like, have been going around for a number of years. But this new agreement, regulates that a bit more. Now, the people who support it and think it's a good thing and have wanted it to happen believe it'll unleash a real torrent of funding for projects in poorer countries, because it's cheaper for richer countries essentially to pay others to do their dirty work for them, if you like, reduce their emissions rather than reduce them themselves. And it's the added benefit of development in other countries. But there's a lot of pushback from other poorer countries and from a lot of environmentalists who are very concerned about this, who think it will do just that. It will allow some people to get out of jail free. And it's just so, these projects are often, have been in the past, associated with fraud, with lack of permits. You know, people pay for forests, the forests burn down, what happened to the carbon, who owns that carbon? There's a whole range of complex issues around these, and it's not the simple solution, if you like, even though many would welcome it.
The BBC's environment correspondent Matt McGrath there, who's at COP29 in Baku. So as the environmentalists warn of more extreme weather events as the balance of our ecosystems and climate changes, and world leaders discuss what we should do about it, what about when climate change affects you, when your home or life is destroyed by an extreme weather event? The authorities in Spain are still looking for around 40 people missing since the flash flooding that happened in Valencia recently. And I've been speaking to Tara Sisco. She's from Nova Scotia in eastern Canada. And last year, her little boy Colton, who's only six, was swept away and killed in flash floods there. She began by telling me about the day in July last year when the rain started and just didn't stop.
It was very eerie. Starting early on in the day, around 10 a.m., it was like a constant rumble of thunder. It just seemed to thunder all day. And you would get little flashes throughout the day. By the time I finally went to work, so I made it very hard to try and sleep for my night shift. I didn't sleep at all. I worked at 7 in the evening. By then, it started to rain. And from there, it rained from 7 p.m. to approximately 8 a.m. the next day. And it wasn't a constant drizzle. It wasn't just, this is some rain. It was raining obscene amounts of rain. It was crazy. It's hard to describe.
And you were on a night shift, as you say, and your little boy, Colton, was staying with his dad that night, I understand.
Yes, he was staying with his dad that night, as he usually would have, because we worked exact opposite shifts, so it worked out really well, and that's where he was. He was with his dad.
And then you heard over the radio, I think, that the area where he was staying with his dad was being particularly badly affected by this flash flooding.
Yes. So I had been scrolling on Facebook, and some people on Facebook had mentioned that they were listening to scanners online from first responders, and I happened to loop in and also listen to those scanners, and it was there that I learned that the flooding was getting really bad in that area.
So you tried to contact Colton's dad, Chris, and I think you got through to him on the phone.
I did. So I called him through Facebook. He answered the phone right away. And when he answered the phone, he says, absolutely, I'll get up and I'll look around and I'll check. And when he woke up and put his feet over the bed, he put his feet in water.
Goodness me. So at that point, you knew the situation was really serious. And he tried to get out of the house with Colton as well, didn't he? Tell us what happened next.
He was very panicked. He asked, what should I do? I told him to call 911, that I would try to wake up his neighbors. He lived in a duplex. And I had gone to school with his neighbors. I've known these people for a very long time, and our kids played together. So I called them. I didn't hear from them later. Talking with them, I did wake them up with that call. But Chris had grabbed Colton in the meantime, grabbed his dog, and he tried to get out of the house. But there was so much pressure on the house that he originally couldn't open the door to the home.
Pressure because the water was building up and flooding straight through.
Yes, and he did eventually get the door open. By then, he walked out and he had to walk in the bushes to try and not get pulled away. But his truck floated by him and left him in the yard. And he got to the front of the house where he helped open the door for his neighbors. And from there, that family of four, Chris and Colton, got into a truck. They had no high spots and there was no hills. There was no way to get on the roof of the house. The house was starting to move. They got in a truck and they thought that they could get 20 feet to dry land. However, the current coming through that area picked up the truck and put them into the field, which was 15 feet deep. They got sucked out. The parents got sucked out. There was a two-year-old involved. He was attached to his mother's chest. They went out one window and the kids never made it out. They didn't have time to grab them. They couldn't reach for them. It wasn't a fact that they left them. They just, there was no time. It happened so fast. And they didn't leave the truck willingly. They got stuck out of the vehicle with the windows down. So Colton never made it out.
No, he was drowned, Colton, just 6 years old. I mean, the way you describe this, I know you've spoken to Chris and had the story from him, but it just sounds absolutely terrifying that the force of the water was what it was, and the speed at which this happened, that the adults weren't able to even stand or even swim in the water because the currents seemed to be so strong.
Yeah, there wasn't any swimming. It was, you kind of bobbed up above the water and it was floating.
And this is something that had never happened in that area before. It wasn't known for flooding before. This kind of rain hadn't happened before. There was no real warning, it sounds.
The area tend to always gather water in like the farmer's field, and it would get flooding, but never to the degree where you were worried that you would have to look like 10 feet up in the air and see water marks.
And I mean, this sounds like a really stupid question, but what kind of impact has Colton's death had on your family and on his dad, who was with him when it happened?
His dad, as much as he had no control over the situation, his dad feels extreme guilt. And even though he shouldn't feel guilty, that's, you know, he tried, but he's gonna live with that. He had to watch our son die, essentially, and there is nothing he could do.
It is so difficult for all of you, Tara. Do you get the feeling that people are waking up to what needs to happen, that the fact that our climate is changing, that these extreme weather events are taking people by surprise, and it's happening now, it's not in the future anymore?
Yeah, I think some people definitely are waking up. I know here in Nova Scotia, we had all talked about, you know, this doesn't happen here. This type of weather doesn't happen here. It's something that happens in third world countries, was actually something the insurance company quoted to us. We were like, yeah, it happened here. It happened in Canada, and it happened here in Nova Scotia. And when people were talking, we're like, we're never going to see this type of storm again. It's like a 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000 year storm is what people were saying. Ultimately, not even a year later, we had another youth die 20 minutes away from obscene amounts of rain in another town called Wolfville. It happened again. So yeah, I think people are starting to realize that these weather events are not stopping.
And that was Tara Sisko there speaking to us from Nova Scotia in Canada. She lost her son Colton in flash floods last year in Nova Scotia. Coming up later in the programme, we'll be hearing about the female magician who tricked her way into Britain's all-male magic circle club, but who has since vanished.
Not only did she get away with it by convincing these men that she was indeed male, she also was very good because she passed. And this wasn't just something they came up with on a whim. It was about an 18-month orchestrated deception.
More on that intriguing story later. Other headlines this hour, the leader of the Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has resigned after a report found he'd failed to do enough to stop a prolific child abuser. We'll have more on that story momentarily. And 35 people are now known to have been killed in a car ramming outside a sports venue in southern China. More on that to come too this hour. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Now, as Donald Trump begins to assemble his team for his next administration, having won the US election, many around the world are particularly interested in his foreign policy. There are reports that suggest Senator Marco Rubio of Florida could be set to become Donald Trump's Secretary of State. That would be his top diplomat. Congressman Mike Walls has also been floated as a possible national security advisor. They're both known for their tough line on relations with China, as is Mr. Trump himself. So what will the US policy on China be? I've been speaking to Dennis Wilder. He's former senior National Security Council official and senior director for China at the White House under George W. Bush.
Well, I think this administration has two watch phrases. One is a throwback to Ronald Reagan, which is peace through strength. In other words, bolstering our defense capabilities quite significantly, in this case, in the Indo-Pacific, but also a philosophy of America first, but not America only, which is a philosophy that says that we need to obviously take care of ourselves first, but we need to work with our allies in areas like the Indo-Pacific. And so the Japanese have moved to much greater defense spending. The Koreans are spending more on their capability. The Philippines is working with us more. And I would see them accelerating this kind of capability in order to tell the Chinese, don't even think of taking coercive action against Taiwan, and don't think of acting in the South China Sea against those nations who also have claims there.
But given Mr. Trump's, let's say, negative attitude towards foreign wars, as he puts it, is he likely to want to get involved in anything around Taiwan?
Well, the whole point of this position is avoidance of war. And their belief is that the greater our capability in the Indo-Pacific against this very large growing Chinese military, the Chinese Navy is now over 300 ships, larger than the American Navy, that the United States has to prove we have the strength to deter them, while at the same time being willing to negotiate with the Chinese.
Let's talk about trade for a moment, because this is another of the big policies that Mr. Trump's been talking about, tariffs in particular. Do you think that's likely to become a reality? And what would the impact of putting tariffs on China be for the United States?
I think the Chinese have a big decision to make here. From my point of view, Trump, who is well known for his belief in the art of the trade, I think this is a negotiating ploy to some degree. In other words, if China is not willing to work on the trade balance, yes, 60% or more tariffs could go into place. So he, remember, had constructed a deal in 2020 with the Chinese government where they were going to rebalance trade. COVID got in the way and that deal was never consummated. I think he will want to go back to some kind of deal like that with the Chinese, and the Chinese will have to decide whether or not they want to negotiate with him. And I think that his very real threat of tariffs will probably bring them back to the table.
And we look at the language that we've had under the Biden administration on human rights in terms of China, particularly with, you know, religious freedoms around Muslims, Uyghurs in China and Christians, also under George Bush, your former boss. Is that something that Mr. Trump will continue, or will he move away from that?
Well, in the Congress, Senator Rubio and then Representative Waltz have been proponents of such things as the Uyghur bill, which said that American companies would have to prove that they were not using forced labor in their products. So I think those kinds of actions will be taken. But frankly, okay, American administrations have tended to talk tough on human rights in China, but taken very little real action.
That was Dennis Wilder there, Senior Director for China at the White House under George W. Bush. Now, the spiritual leader of the worldwide Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has resigned within the past hour. It comes after days of mounting pressure over his handling of an abuse scandal some years ago. A report published last week accused the Church of England of covering up violent attacks on over 100 boys and young men committed by British lawyer John Smythe, who was a layperson active in the church. He actually died in 2018 before facing justice. The Anglican community, of course, has about 85 million worshippers worldwide and is active in about 165 countries. Let's cross live to our correspondent following this. Harry Farley joins us now. And Harry, I see in a statement from Justin Welby, he said he was stepping aside in the best interests of the Church of England. Just remind us of the roots of this story and what's led to him stepping down today.
Well, the roots are with a man called John Smythe, who abused dozens of boys in the UK initially in the 1970s and 80s at Christian camps that Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, himself attended as a young man. John Smythe then moved to Zimbabwe and South Africa, where he continued to abuse many more boys. And he has been described in that report that was published last week as arguably the most prolific abuser the Church of England has to be associated with the Church of England. So this is a very serious man. And the report described the beatings that Smythe gave to teenage boys in particular as prolific, brutal and horrific. And I suppose the key reason that Justin Welby has been criticised personally over this was that he was told at the latest in 2013 about Smythe's abuse. He was told that it had been reported to the police, but he did not himself ensure that that was the case. He did not, in his words, he did not do enough to energetically follow up those allegations and make sure that they were pursued. Right. And Smythe died in 2018 before he could be brought to justice.
Just briefly, will others within the church also need to face questioning on this? Because, of course, Mr. Welby, Justin Welby wouldn't have been acting alone. Other people may well have known about
this. No, completely. There are others within the Church of England. I mean, the report goes on to say that the church knew at the highest levels about the abuse, but its response was wholly ineffective and amounted to a cover-up. And so there are certainly others, other bishops, other senior figures, other church officials in particular, who knew of Smythe's abuse and did not do enough, in the words of the report, to make sure that those allegations were followed up. So I think this could well not just end with Justin Welby.
And away from this story, I mean, it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, that Justin Welby has been a pretty popular Archbishop of Canterbury in recent years. I don't think he was due to step down anytime soon. What happens next?
Well, he needed to retire. He needs to retire before his 70th birthday, so he was expected to retire anyway in the next sort of 6 to 8 months or so. In terms of what happens next, there will be a sort of this nationwide consultation across the UK, hearing from what people want from the next Archbishop of Canterbury. That will then inform what is, I guess, a long list of suitable candidates. No one applies to be the next Archbishop of Canterbury. You are invited for interview, and that interview is conducted by a committee that will be set up in the next few months. The Prime Minister of the UK appoints the chair of that committee, but it's made up of different people, not just from the Church of England, but also from representatives of that Anglican Communion right around the world. And they will interview the long list of candidates, and 2/3 of them need to agree before the next Archbishop of Canterbury is chosen. But we're expecting that process to last for several months.
OK, that will be interesting indeed. Thank you so much, Harry Farley, there on that story. And there's much more on the BBC website with the background of this particular case and also the workings of the Church of England and the worldwide Anglican Church. Welcome back to NewsHour. The great white shark is one of the world's most impressive apex predators. Essentially a giant fish, the great white is a stealthy, sleek killer that silently stalks its prey before attacking with enormous speed and ferocity. Its preferred prey would be a nice, plump seal, but it does occasionally attack humans, especially surfers, which can look a bit seal-shaped on their boards. Now Australian marine biologist and keen surfer Dr. Laura Ryan has found a way to deter great whites from attacking surfers. It's lights on their boards. She told me more.
So our research has been looking at how great white sharks interact with first a seal-shaped decoy, and we've been using lights on the bottom of these decoys. And we tested a whole heap of designs, from completely covering these decoys in lights to just doing different sort of patterns. So the stripes being horizontal, which if we imagine on a seal from one shoulder to the other, seems to be most effective, and it needs to be sort of brighter or equal to the background lighting.
And what's the thinking behind that then, that it sort of changes the outline shape of these things that look like seals that you're experimenting with?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So what we're doing is we're changing the shape of the silhouette. And when we're not covering the entire decoy in LEDs and just doing these horizontal stripes, there is remaining areas where there is a silhouette, but this remaining section looks more like multiple small objects.
So it looks a bit unusual and less tasty, basically, to a hungry great white.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, so you're a neurobiologist, aren't you? So you look at the sensory nature of sharks and great whites, I guess, in particular. And they are supposed to have amazing smell, but maybe not such good eyesight?
So it's actually that their vision is quite different. It sort of suits the marine environment, but I guess it's just very different to ours. Where we see colour, colour isn't important to sharks and they tend to be colourblind. We're also very detail-orientated. Sharks don't see as much detail as us. If you imagine taking your goggles off underwater, that blurry image is about the same amount of detail that a shark can see.
And so your research, I suppose, is to make it more possible to coexist with sharks, because other shark mechanisms like nets and things like that seem to be a bit more about scaring sharks away and, you know, changing their behaviour rather than ours.
I guess that's where sort of a device stemming from this research could come in handy, because it presents a novel way or a new way that we might be able to prevent bites, but also have less of an impact on other marine animals. Like, it's something that I really want to integrate into surfboards, and we're sort of working on building a prototype at the moment.
Dr. Laura Ryan from Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. She's also a keen surfer herself, speaking to us earlier. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Let's get more on that news breaking from China within the past couple of hours, that a car has struck a crowd of people outside a sports centre in southern China. It's thought around 35 people were killed and a further 43 were injured. Police in the city of Zhuhai have arrested a 62-year-old man at the scene. And earlier I spoke to our correspondent Stephen McDonald, who's actually in Zhuhai at the moment where the attack took place. He gave us the details.
The attack, which happened very close to where I am now, apparently was carried out by a man who was upset about his divorce proceedings, if you can believe it. He was upset with the settlement. He apparently went to court a few times trying to have it overturned and failed. And the police are saying as a result of this, he decided to take this out on dozens of people who he's killed by driving his car into the crowds of people outside a stadium, just doing ordinary evening sports, jogging, some of them dancing. And apart from those he's killed, also many more dozens have been injured who are still in hospital, and we're getting crowds gathering at the hospital as people try to, you know, donate blood to help the victims. But, you can imagine the shock here. It's just such an inexplicably awful thing to have done in response to what is essentially, I mean, it's a terrible personal grievance for him, but, you know, to be taking it out on complete strangers, how do you explain it?
Well, absolutely. So the authorities are describing this as an attack. We understand that news of this on social media seems to be being tampered with or erased even. And I understand that you were trying to report from the scene and were prevented. Tell us about that.
Well, this is, you know, how the authorities roll in China. As stuff happens, there's a bit of discussion about it, and then soon they're shutting down discussion. So references to this incident, of course, would be censored. And if you go to the site, I've just come from there. Now, if I could just describe it a bit, like, the stadium's in darkness, all around the stadium now is in darkness, the gates in front closed. There are only a couple of security guards wandering around inside, and they've obviously been told to be on the lookout for any reporters, because when they saw us, they came over and started asking, you know, who we were, what we were doing. And other people were just riding past to have a look, as you might imagine, in a pretty somber type of way. But there was a little group of, you know, I guess you'd expect that they were sort of party loyalists there to prevent any such reporting. And soon they were pushing us, shoving, shouting, hands in front of the camera, you know, grabbing the BBC cameraman, Ed Lawrence, and, you know, grabbing me. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just how officials roll. I guess they try to, they think it's going to help the situation, but it does make China look pretty bad.
The BBC's Stephen McDonald in Zhuhai speaking to us a short time ago. Let's go to the Middle East now, because a US deadline set 30 days ago for Israel to improve the desperate humanitarian situation in Gaza expires today. The United Nations says Israel hasn't done nearly enough to meet the American demands, which include allowing more aid in, evacuating the sick and critically injured, and limiting civilian casualties. Israel has crossed many of America's red lines before during the course of its war against Hamas, with very few consequences. So how might the US respond now in the dying days of the Biden presidency? Israel doesn't allow international journalists uncontrolled access to Gaza. So our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, has this report.
Stretched out in front of five-year-old Nizar in a makeshift morgue in central Gaza, are white plastic body bags. The small boy leans down and peeps into one of them. He needs to see with his own eyes, which are filled with tears. In the bag is his auntie. His uncle, their children, and Nizar's sister, Khaloud, were also killed when Israel attacked a school housing displaced families. Israel's military says it was targeting Hamas. God is all we need, cries Barah, Nizar's brother. Much of Gaza is now unlivable. A month ago, America once again demanded Israel take steps to reduce the number of civilian casualties. The United Nations says more than 1,000 people have been killed in the last 30 days. The majority, it says, were civilians. There is food in Gaza. This is a bakery. Hot, puffed-up pitas roll out of the oven on a conveyor belt. Outside, hundreds of people desperately scramble to get their hands on the bread. Among them, grandmother Aida Al-Haran, who's also been picking up soup.
If it were not for the soup kitchen, we would have starved to death. Every day it's the same struggle. I go back and forth to the soup kitchen.
What food there is not enough. We've come now to Zakim, a military base right on the edge of Gaza. The Gaza Strip is really just only a few metres away behind a 10-metre-high fence covered with barbed wire. And there's a gate where these trucks that are queued up in front of me carrying food aid are going to cross into Gaza. Israel has allowed more crossings to open, especially into northern Gaza. But America demanded that by now Israel should be allowing a minimum of 358 trucks into the territory every day. The United Nations says that over the past month, the daily average has been only just over 40 trucks.
We need safe facilitation of aid into the Gaza Strip, and we are not receiving...
Israel does not allow international journalists free access to Gaza. But in a video call, I spoke to Louise Wateridge from UNRWA, the main UN aid agency there.
There is not enough aid here. There is not enough supplies. People are starving in areas. People are very hungry. They are fighting over bags of flour. There is just not enough supplies.
For more than a year, Israel has crossed most of America's red lines. Much of this was done using US weapons. But in the dying days of the Biden presidency, and with more than 43,000 Palestinian lives lost, it's unlikely the White House will put its foot down and cut off arms supplies.
The BBC's John Donison reporting from Jerusalem. Oil oil giant Shell has won its appeal against a 2021 court ruling ordering it to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 45%. 3 years ago, a court in The Hague backed environmentalist group Friends of the Earth and 17,000 Dutch citizens in requiring Shell to reduce emissions in line with the Paris Climate Accords. The appeals court said the firm did have obligations based on people's right to protection against dangerous climate change, but it said that Shell was already taking remedial steps. Friends of the Earth has said the verdict hurt. In an emotional statement, its director Donald Poles said the fight wasn't over.
The strijd tegen gevaarlijke klimaatverandering is een marathon.
The fight against dangerous climate change is a marathon, not a sprint. And the race has only just begun. Shell is and remains one of the world's biggest polluters and must take responsibility for solving the climate problem.
Well, Lucas Rodder is an assistant professor at Utrecht University and specialises in accountability of corporations. So what's his assessment of the ruling?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. So in a lot of ways, the court confirms the decision of the lower court, but it comes to a different conclusion, mostly when it comes to does Shell actually meet its obligations. So it says, yes, Shell does have these obligations to reduce, but we think they're already on the right path. And insofar as they might not be, it's very difficult to quantify that. So we don't have the basis to make an additional court order. That's basically the conclusions.
Right. So the Shell appeals team seems to have done a good job then to get this passed today. But how much of a blow will it be for the environmentalists who say that it's time to target individual polluters?
Well, maybe not so much as it might seem from the outcome, because this is the first domestic court to confirm that there are expectations on companies to reduce emissions. It's the first court to confirm that there are responsibilities to, for example, reduce a human rights impact. And again, that reducing emissions is part of that. On these facts, the court might say, well, we think that Shell is doing enough, but it can take this judgment, at least on the Dutch law, to another company, say, well, they are not doing their job. They are not reducing sufficiently.
I'm just looking at some of the statistics from Shell on its emissions, mm-hmm. and they do look as if they're coming steadily down, more so in the past 3 years. They're saying now their aim is to lower their emissions, CO2 emissions, by 20% by 2030. But for scale, how does Shell compare in terms of emissions to other big companies or even countries? I mean, are they so much more polluting than others?
First of all, I have to say I'm not a climate scientist, but what we do know is that Shell, like other oil companies, has a significant and quantifiable impact on global emissions, on climate change. We're talking like several percentage points worth of emissions. But what is important is it's not just, of course, and that was the whole discussion in this case, it's not just Shell, like the companies it owns and the stuff it burns itself, but it's really the fuel it sells and sort of the emissions that accumulate as a result of those fuels. Also, the influence that Shell as a company has on how do you price your fuels, how do you price, let's say, green energy compared to fossil fuels and so on, the decision to open up new oil fields. So there they don't just have an impact in terms of their own emissions, but how much is emitted in total. And yes, they definitely have a significant impact on par with some countries.
And in terms of other legal cases that there could be around the world, looking at the impact of climate change and CO2 emissions from a human rights perspective, what kind of impact might this have on those cases?
What I really like about this case is that the court extensively talks about other cases. It talks about a lot of other national courts having similar issues. So what you see is that courts are recognizing this is not just us talking about it. It's a network of interlinked decisions, and they're reinforcing each other, again, in confirming that same rule, like we need to do something about this. And the law tells us we need to do something about this. And it's not just governments. It's also private actors like companies.
So the big polluters then, to put it bluntly, do need to be thinking about the human rights of people to clean air and safe environments going forward.
Absolutely. From a legal perspective and, of course, from a social perspective.
That was Lucas Rodder, their assistant professor at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. He specialises in accountability of corporations. They're responding to that ruling coming from a Dutch court today about the emissions of the oil company Shell. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Is the Iraqi parliament about to lower the age of consent from 18 to just 9 years old? That's what Shia conservative groups are hoping for. They've proposed an amendment to the personal status law, which could also see changes to a woman's right to inheritance, divorce, and even the custody of her own children. Earlier, I spoke to Razo Salhi, who's an Iraq researcher for Amnesty International. So who is proposing these changes and why?
They're proposed by a coalition of MPs, which are from one of the Shia parties, and they have previously proposed laws that have been restrictive in terms of gender-related rights or sexual orientation rights. It is part of this campaign over the past 2 years that we've seen in Iraq to really what we like to call swapping bullets on the streets for laws in parliament to restrict civil society, restrict freedoms guaranteed already under law. And it's really an exertion of power.
So at the moment in Iraq, like in most countries actually around the world, the legal marriage age is 18. And that's been in place, I think, since the 1950s. This was under secular law. And so how would this change?
Yes, absolutely. So actually, it's worth mentioning that Iraq has one of the most progressive personal status laws in the region, in the Middle East, in that the personal status law encompasses every person of every religion in the country. So it's for all Iraqis. What this would do is open the door for religious clerics of the Shia sect and the Sunni sect and their respective religious authorities to put down codes that may allow girls as young as 9 to get married. And the fear of that stems from the fact that the amendment explicitly recognizes the Ja'fari school of thought for the Shia sect. And those who interpreted the dogmatic way could allow girls as young as 9 to get married and boys as young as 15 to be married, which is a complete disaster and allow really opens or exposes girls to sexual violence and other types of violence, and notwithstanding the fact that they'll be excluded from education and any type of meaningful ways of building a life.
So, I mean, just to be clear, is this law, this would be coexisting alongside the secular law, would it? So this would be a branch of religious law that families could choose to adopt?
Yes, exactly. So what it does is it establishes a parallel sectarian judicial authority that essentially makes women or children, Iraqi women and children, unequal before the law. It allows for men to shop around for the best situation, be it in marriage or be it in divorce settlements, be it in inheritance settlements, and even custody of children.
And this really would be a break with what we've seen in Iraq legally over decades.
Absolutely. It is a devastating blow to years of women's rights NGOs, of progress in human rights. And I have to mention, those pushing this law have demonized the opposing voices in parliament and outside parliament. They have called them Western influences, as well as morality that is not in line with Iraq's moral standards. That is completely untrue. They are coming from the streets of Iraq. They are not coming from outside at all.
Razo Salhi there from Amnesty International. Now, have you ever heard of the Magic Circle? It's a highly prestigious, pretty secretive club of magicians here in Britain. It started in the 19th century, and it's quite difficult to get in. You have to pass a magic exam involving complex tricks and illusions. You also have to swear an oath never to reveal Magic Circle secrets. And until 1991, you also had to be a man. Well, one woman did manage to trick her way in. Before that, she dressed as a man and called herself Raymond Lloyd. When the rules then changed in 1991 to allow women, she revealed her true female identity and was promptly thrown out anyway for deliberate deception. The woman seemingly then vanished as if into thin air and hasn't been seen since. Well, now the new and first female chair of the Magic Circle is trying to find her. I've been speaking to her, Laura London.
Well, it's quite an extraordinary story. It seems that this wasn't just a one-person job, though. This was a two-man job, should I say, or two-woman job, in actual fact. A woman called Jenny Winstanley was a magician who was working in the seaside resorts around Great Yarmouth, and I suspect desperately wanted to be a member of the most prestigious magic society in the world, the Magic Circle, but couldn't get in. So she came up with this idea that she would train up an actress friend of hers called Sophie Lloyd, and they would sort of dupe the Magic Circle into believing that Sophie was indeed a man called Raymond Lloyd, and Raymond would have to go in and do an exam in front of magicians. So not only did she get away with it by convincing these men that she was indeed male, she also was very good because she passed. And this wasn't just something they came up with on a whim. It was about an 18-month orchestrated deception, a heist as it was. And I love that they did it. It was almost to prove that the women were just as good as the men.
Now, she did come clean in 1991 when women were allowed to be admitted. And it was almost like the big reveal behind the curtain. She threw off the disguise and said, ta-da, I've been female all along. And they kicked her out anyway. Then she disappears as if by magic. Where is she now? Do we know?
Well, first of all, I mean, that's the saddest thing about it. The saddest thing, I'm sure that both Sophie and Jenny thought that the Magic Circle find it incredibly funny, you know, being entertainers and all, and of course, keep her in the society. And then hopefully Jenny would have joined as well, and it would have been lovely. I'm sure that was what was expected, but that didn't happen. We don't hear much about her until 1997, where there's an article in a newspaper, should I say, in Leamington Spa, where she was doing educational shows. It was called the Wellhard Show, and it was an anti-bullying campaign, and she was using magic in that. That was then sort of when the trail goes cold from then. Nobody's sort of heard of her since. We have had a little update though. Since today, it is quite possible that Sophie Lloyd was actually her acting name, and her real name might have been Sue or Susan.
You've now become the first female chair of the Magic Circle, and you want to, what, make amends, welcome her back? And why is this important to you?
Well, it's not just me. The entire Magic Society, our president, Marvin Berglass, and everybody within it, it's a different time. We're very diverse, we're inclusive. And this story, we want to share it. We want to bring her back. That would be the first thing. To invite her back to the society would be absolutely amazing. I personally would like to thank her for doing this because I think it was a brave, brave thing to do. And her point was proven so brilliantly well. And I guess, you know, the least we can do is apologise.
And that was the first female chair of the Magic Circle, Laura London there. And Sue or Sophie Lloyd or Raymond Lloyd, if you're out there listening, get in touch and we'll put you in touch with the Magic Circle. That's it for this edition. Thanks for listening.